For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there, Second City Hockey listeners, it's Dave Melton here, and before we get to the show, I wanted to let you in on a little secret. All of those ads you just heard, if you want to listen to the show without them, visit SecondCityHockey.com and sign up for either one of our subscription tiers, where the perks include ad-free versions of the Musings on Madison podcast.
And with the first overall selection in the 2023 NHL Draft, the Chicago Blackhawks are very proud to select, from the Regina Pats, the Western Hockey League, Connor Bedard.
That's going wild! Good! Game on! Hey, want to play some hockey?
Score, Chicago!
Welcome into another episode of Musing on Madison here on the Second City Hockey Podcast Network. I'm your host, Dave Melton, the site manager at Second City Hockey. You can find me on Twitter at dmelt57, and the main account is at 2ndcityhockey. Same updates as we always do every week. If you want to support our website, one of the best things you can do is leave us a 5-star review wherever it is you are listening to this podcast. If you leave us 4 stars or fewer, we assume you're a Blues fan. SecondCityHockey.com is where we have all our game previews, recaps, game threads during each game, and a whole bunch of other stuff. That's also where you can find our exclusive content, the Corey Crawford tier, $5 a month, Connor Bedard tier, $10 a month. Best way to support the website. There's also merch available at that website, so you can support us in a whole bunch of different ways. And we thank everyone for the support that has literally kept us going and is the reason why we are still here to this day. Little shorthanded this week. Once again, we had to shuffle the lineup around, but we've got two of the other three usual line mates with me this evening. Up first, she is not on Twitter, but she's at SecondCityHockey.com under the name LBR. It's Betsy. Oh, where she is, the Second City Hockey Bulletin Wall of Text. How did I forget? It's Betsy.
I was going to say.
I know. Sorry, I'm slacking.
It's okay. If I sound a little low energy, I actually think I got like a second wind. It's because I was back in Atlanta taking care of hopefully the very last bits before I sell my condo.
I don't know if the people, I don't know how much we've talked about it on the air or during podcasts, but I know we've had plenty of behind the scenes discussions via Slack channels that this has been quite the saga for you, but it sounds like it's getting near the end of it.
I have I don't know if I've ever said it on air, but I have a water curse on me. somebody has a voodoo doll of me and is just dipping me in water every year. It's partially like that's the way that I view it. So when the pandemic hit, I went to stay with my mom, and then she had some health issues. So I'm just going to continue to stay with my mom. And I was just going to put my condo up for renting because I didn't want to sell it. And to get on the renters list, they're like, it's at least a 2, maybe even 3-year wait list, because only 10% in our building. Oof. It'll be 3 years in January, and I'm still like 16 people back. So this last water incident, I was like, I came up to check something randomly, and there was like water all in my hallway from a HVAC unit overfreeze or something from the people above me. So I was like, you know what? This is number 5 in 5 years.
I'm out. This is the 5th strike. I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, I have the condo is brand new because one of them destroyed everything. Like, my floors are brand new. My bathroom's brand new. My kitchen is now pretty much brand new. The cabinets are the same, but they've been painted. And I got new countertops and backsplash. All my appliances are brand new. So whoever buys my place is getting pretty much a brand new place. Like, my entire ceiling's brand new, all the light fixtures, like, everything had to go. after that one water incident.
You know what? You should have said something. I could have bent like the reverse voodoo curse on you for when I was down on my trip this weekend. I could have plenty of voodoo stuff going on there. So
I'm just I'm hoping that just leaving it, the curse will stay there or something.
the curse is with the deed of the property. So once it transfers over, that's how this one works. Got it.
I mean, to be fair, most of if the water damage was extensive because nobody is there. You know, like if I was there, the water incident that happened, the major one, was like in the laundry room. It would never have, like, I would have seen that before it got so big. But I wasn't there. The person above me, what they did was they were brand new renters and they put clothes in the washing machine and then left for the weekend. And the washing machine had some type of malfunction. But first of all, who puts clothes in a washing machine and then leaves for days? That's disgusting. But I my place was empty and the place below me was empty. I'm on the third floor and nobody noticed it until the retail store on the bottom floor came in on Monday.
Yikes.
So the people below me pretty much got like a new place too.
Yeah. So, well, we wish you a speedy end to that saga. Cause I've said it's been a whole thing. Also with us this evening, back on Twitter at Eric GEG, the official Second City Hockey Pizza correspondent, it's Eric Gegenheimer.
Well, I was waiting for Betsy to grab her Coke root beer so we could get on the air tonight. I was looking at, I won't say the publication because it's owned by Vox Media, so middle finger.
Yeah,
but it was an interview with Michael Bolton about the oral history of the Jack Sparrow song that he did with Lonely Island. And just outstanding, just an outstanding piece of comedy across the board. So anybody who hasn't watched it in a while, it's funnier than you remember. Go watch it.
There we go. Got recommendations for a little bit of everything from this corner of the internet.
Have you seen it before? Have you both seen it?
I have not.
You have not? Okay. Dave, you should watch it after
sorry.
This. It's pretty incredible. I don't know. I just assume, I guess, Lonely Island is like so in the zeitgeist that everyone has seen everything major that they've done. But Dave, you should watch it immediately after we get off later. And I won't say anything else to let you go in
it's entirely as blind as possible. It's entirely possible that I have, and now I'm just like, because I feel like I've seen most of their stuff. But I don't know, drawing a blank.
Okay.
Whatever. We'll come back to it later. So since we've last talked, once again, there have been two Blackhawks games. It feels like this part of the schedule has been very light, and I think they're going to make up for that in December because it seems like they play every other day for the entire month of December, except for the 2 or 3 days off for Christmas. So the Blackhawks beat the Florida Panthers, and then they lost to the New Jersey Devils because it seems like the Blackhawks are very good at having one really, really good game and then having one really, really bad game, no matter who they are playing. So as we will get into later on in this conversation, I did not see 95% of these two games because I was out of town in an area where hockey isn't exactly a hotbed. So I'm just going to direct this over to Betsy first and just ask, what I miss? Anything good?
I mean, the Florida game was really fun.
It looked fun on the scoreboard.
Yes. Well, I mean, so they had a really good first period and then had two so-so other periods, which is the same thing they did in Jersey and the same thing they've done in most of their games. So it's not like they're playing really a full game still, but they got lucky because the goalie for the Panthers, like, I've never, like, he, when Zaitsev? What am I saying?
Zaitsev?
Yeah, we go.
Your favorite?
I know, I'm never gonna. I feel almost like I'm insulting him.
Don't worry, by next April, you won't have to say that name ever again.
No. He froze as if that guy was like Ovechkin or Matthews or somebody that's crazy. Why did you do that? Like, he looked so like scared. But otherwise, I think they dominated the play. They did a really good job of controlling them. They spent more time in the OZ than maybe any other game, or like definitely up there in that one period. And then they did a decent job of shot suppression in the second. The last two periods, especially the third, I think they only allowed for like 5 high danger chances at 5-on-5, which is not like super low, but it's also not like they've been in double digits for some.
Could have been worse as well.
Yeah, I mean, in the New Jersey game, they didn't have one below, like it was like 7-7-7, I want to say, which also wasn't that bad, but like it's still like that's a normal thing for them. And then the New Jersey game was kind of the opposite. They still had a pretty good first period, but the goalie was better. And then they had a really terrible second period, like a horrible, no good second period. And they just didn't get scored on, really. And then the third period, just everything, the New Jersey rode into the third period on a high. So it was really hard for them to come back. It is what it is. Like, both teams were good, so it was great for them to get a win against one. It would have been nice if they hadn't had that flat line in the middle of the New Jersey game, but it was also a back-to-back. The goalie for New Jersey, whose name I'm blanking on, starts with a V.
Vitek Vanacek.
Yeah, he was great. He robbed Bedard on two occasions. Yeah, I saw.
I saw the Tyler Johnson highlight across Twitter in several places, and it was.
Oh yeah, that was.
I mean, it looked like Johnson probably could have got rid of the puck a little bit quicker, but still, like a hell of a save.
Yeah, there were. You know, it is like I said. It was the opposite. They probably shouldn't have had three goals in the first period of the Panthers game, but they did because the goalie was a little off his game. And then they probably could have had at least a couple of other goals in the Jersey game if the goalie hadn't been so on top of his game. So.
Well, sounds a lot in line with what I read and heard. And I think I looked at the natural stats trick stuff after the games and, of course, read the recaps at secondcityhockey.com. Because where else would you go if you missed the Blackhawks game and needed to catch up on it? But, like, it looked like the Florida game just seemed, like, very score-effecty that the Hawks got the three quickly. And then Florida kind of took over from there, even if it wasn't, like, it didn't quite – it was like Florida was throwing everything at the Hawks net, but they were definitely generating more play, but the Hawks were already up 3 and then 4-0 at that point. So it didn't make as much of a difference. And the New Jersey game just seemed like, yeah, you know, it happened. Eric, what about anything else I missed? Anything else I should be aware of?
First of all, I'm always here for a stone-faced response to a big moment, which was Bedard's goal. Which is that nasty wrist shot. But I love that. Like, NBA guys used to do that. Derrick Rose did that once. I think it was Damian Lillard famously did that once. Just a total non-response to a big moment. But the other thing, I think those were Kaiser's best two games. He looked a lot more like he did in the preseason when everyone was kind of, you know, climbing up on the bandwagon. He looked a lot more aggressive. He was moving the puck really well. He seemed to be reading everything really well. So that was somebody that he just kind of stood out to me. And then other than just to say, to make note of it, in the Jersey game when Bedard set up Kurashev, that was a great look by Bedard. And that was a great shot by Kurashev too. Vanacek just beat him and he made a really nice save at the end. But I think that's, you know, he's been scoring pretty well. He really hasn't had many opportunities to set anyone else up yet. But that was one instance where everyone is screaming. They know he's going to shoot it. And he used that to his advantage to put Kurashev in a really good position to score. And unfortunately, just didn't work out. But that was another thing that really stuck out to me from the two games this weekend.
So it seems like I'm very glad to hear the thing about Wyatt Kaiser, because I didn't I was perusing Twitter as much as I could, which is to say not much at all because I was busy doing other things over the weekend. So I did not see any mention of Wyatt Kaiser to the degree you said, Eric. So that's very good to hear, because it seemed like he'd had some rougher goes earlier on, and maybe at some point, I can't remember exactly when, But some point between the start of the season and now, they switched him from playing on his offhand back to his forehand. And I can't remember if that's right to left or left to right. But either way, they had him switch sides. And it seemed like he's been playing better since he switched sides. And it seems like that trend has continued. And Bedard scored another goal. And it also seemed like the general consensus was Lucas Reichel looked very good on the wing. Was that fair to conclude as well?
I think he looks better in the Florida game. I didn't notice him that much in the Jersey game. He had a really nice, I think it was Kulikov, that he went like inside outside on him and brought it back.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't able to finish it. Stolarz kind of flashed across and made a pretty decent save. But that was not anything I've seen from him so far yet this year. So, I mean, that's telling you, you know, his confidence level, he's feeling better when he has the puck and he feels like he can do that. Yeah. So that was really good to see. But yeah, I don't really remember him much from the Jersey game from what I watched, but maybe that's just me. I don't know if anything jumped out to Betsy about him from that game.
I don't really remember that many like players doing positive things in the New Jersey game to like any absurd degree. Like there were Bedard looked good. I think Hall looked good. He got moved up to Bedard's line. And they looked good together. I think Kurashev looked good. Kaiser, you're right, he looked good. Vlasic looked good. Korchinski had some moments, but I don't...
I saw he had a really, really bad giveaway in the New Jersey game.
He did.
Led directly to a goal, which it'll happen.
It was... Well, and also, that the puck was bouncing. He just didn't... Like, it blocked off somebody, and then you know how a lot of players will just slap it to try to get it out of the... zone. That's what happened. And somebody had said, well, why wasn't Jones back with him? And I was like, why would Jones be back in that situation? They were in like a diamond formation at that point. There's no way nobody would like in that instance. It sucks that he was by himself, but he almost got completely back. He hit the guy's stick right when his shot was going off. So he almost recovered enough to prevent a shot from even really going off. So kudos to him, like a little bit better timing. And I think like that's the difference between when if Tenorti had made that mistake versus because one Tenorti would never have turned around in time. Like by the time, you know, he's like, I think he's like a jet plane turning around. There's just no way. But he would never have gotten back. I don't even think like Seth Jones could have gotten back in time. Vlasic is a good skater, but he wouldn't have gotten back in time. Korchinski, Kaiser probably could have. Those two are the best skaters on the D-line. And I think both of them could have gotten, but that's the strength of Korchinski. He'll learn, one, maybe not to make that mistake, but if he does, he'll get even faster and maybe prevent, like be able to get back and prevent his own mistake being an issue.
A very nice tool to have and with his type of play is that if he fucks up egregiously like he did in that situation, sometimes he can get back and fix the problem before it becomes a goal.
Yeah.
So not a bad trait to have at all.
And that was kind of a weird giveaway. That wasn't so much. I actually had a much bigger problem with, I think it was the third New Jersey goal, was the direct result of Bedard trying to do this weird like backhand feed across the ice. And he's tried to do it a couple times now and it's not working. It hasn't worked. I don't think it's a thing that translates to the NHL, or at least it doesn't translate to the way that teams are playing him in the NHL right now. Like it's just not there.
Yeah.
But that led to the Jersey rush up the ice the other way. And I think the Hawks were in the middle of a cycle, if I'm remembering correctly, but it was a really bad turnover. And it's kind of an interesting, he's going to get more rope than anybody. They want him to just be him and to be confident and to do those things. But I wonder, you know, like what the coaching staff says to him, if that gets brought up in that situation, or if he kind of has the runway, they're just going to let him go and let him do that stuff, even if it's mistakes that end up costing them. Because to me, that was a much bigger bad play than the play that ended up, you know, burning them with Korchinski trying to hold the line and not being able to hold on to the puck.
I wonder if you go back to like Kane and Taves rookie season, because everybody knows they were just like let off their leash. They were told to do whatever they wanted. And how many times Kane would try something and it ended up being in the back of their net. I mean, Kane would still try stuff and it would end up in their back of the net all the way to when he hasn't, you know, like that was the whole, like, well, he doesn't play defense, you know, and he'll make mistakes and then not get his stuff. I would rather, since this is a throwaway season, I would rather him continue to try that because I think eventually he'll get the timing right and it'll be great. You know, he's got to learn what he can and can't do, obviously, but he also learned to adjust what he can do to work better in the NHL.
There was a play earlier this season, and I forget who it was against, but where Bedard was kind of dangling at the off, is in the offensive zone just inside the blue line. And I think he threw a reverse hit on somebody in the process. But while he was throwing that hit, the puck was taken from him, and whoever the opponent was went down and scored at the other end. And I think Bedard, I think during that play, he also, like, he came back so far on defense that he left the point open, and his point man ended up scoring. So it was like he was trying so hard to break up the play that he also fucked up his defensive responsibility too. But it's just a little thing like that of learning, A, you probably can't make that move in that dangerous spot just inside the blue line in the offensive zone. And B, when you get back on defense, you still have to be positionally sound and cover the player you're supposed to cover, because if you just skate to the net and stand there, they're going to move the puck around and get open and get a goal anyway. So those are little things that he's just going to learn that things that will be learned at the NHL level.
Yeah. If he's still doing that in year 3-4, then you're like, sir, please stop. I guess I don't even know if he'll still be a pair yet.
I'm not sure there's anything he could do, him or any of the kids could do this season that you'd be like, get all the mistakes out of the way now. Like you said, it's a throwaway season. Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've already seen too. I mean, his hockey sense is just outstanding.
Yeah.
And I think he's a little bit better, like, offensively, because he's so good at like reading plays and knowing what other hockey players are going to do with it. And I think that's just going to get better. You know, the more he gets used to the NHL and the better he gets. So I don't think there's anything to be worried about that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Betsy.
Well, I was going to say, I feel bad a little bit for, like, everybody obviously sees his skill, but he's still not, his points are still not, like, his assist rate isn't, he's got the opposite problem that Logan Cooley has, who is all play make and no, like, I think he just scored his first goal. And then, you know, there's nobody, like, now that Hall is back, maybe, and if Kurashev can sink some, he might be able to get something going, but there's been so many line mates that flub. But the one bad thing about him playing on such a terrible team by design is that his points aren't going to be as, like, lofty as a lot of, I know we did that preseason article about this. I think he's going to hit right around like 60 points is what he's on pace for right now ish over 30 goals, but that's half his, you know, so it'll be interesting to see where he ends up. But the Calder race is going to be, like, tougher for him, I think, because his team is terrible.
The one thing I feel like, and maybe we'll look into this later in the season, is to compare first halves of the season, the second half of the season.
Yeah,
with some of the same guys to see if maybe they picked up the pace. Like, McDavid missed a third of the season with an injury, so he may not be the best case study for that. But to see what other guys like Matthews, McKinnon, and Crosby, what have you, see if like their rate of production increased over the course of the season. Because I feel like it makes sense in I think it makes sense in anybody's head that as they get more games in under their belt and they get more comfortable with the NHL level, they start producing more. But maybe that wasn't the case for players. So, maybe we'll have to do that. Keep an eye on the Second City Hockey. We might write that up one day.
It's crazy too, because I'm saying that while Bedard is still technically tied for second in rookie scoring, but it is like all the rookie scorers are not at, I think they're all like 7 and below, like 0.7.
Yeah. It feels like there's going to be a hat trick. There's going to be a 6-game 8-point stretch, like there, or maybe even more than that. Like there's, it feels like there are binges coming over the course of the season, just because there's too much happening for them to not. I guess.
I think every other kid is older than him too. Yeah. Cooley's like the closest in age, and he's almost 2 years older. He's technically he's 1 year, but like based on months, I think he's like a year and 9 or 10. You know.
And don't forget, the big refrain has been so far, you know, how tough their schedule has been. You know, sure. to start off, and all the teams they're playing, and all the, you know, big number one centers that he's having to go against. So at some point that'll let up a little bit too. And I, you know, I don't know if we'll talk about this more, you know, on the rest of the episode, but there's still like, there's no chemistry built with anybody. It seems like it's period by period. All the lines are being mashed and switched up. So, you know, him and Khrushchev have looked really good in the time that they've been able to play together. So hopefully that just continues and they're able to figure out whoever else is on that other line and they can kind of get it cooking a little bit.
Yep.
So the one other thing I wanted to touch on, and this really didn't have to involve watching the game, is I saw that Sunday night after the game, there was a players only meeting called. I didn't see if they mentioned if there was a specific player or two who called it. I'm guessing it was some combination of Foligno, Perry, Jones, you know, the veterans in the room. It was very interesting to see that, because, you know, they played what seemed like a pretty good game against Florida, and then maybe didn't play as well against New Jersey. And it seemed like the way the players talked about it to the media after the game was, I guess the general message was, we have to play like we did against Florida every night, and playing like we did against New Jersey, this every other game being good thing, is not going to fly at the NHL level. Now, I think from an outside perspective, it's very easy to just say, you know, this isn't a good team. It's not a very good roster. There's not a lot of talent on it. They're going to lose a lot of games like this. But for me, like, I'm fascinated and intrigued, and also find it very important, the idea of, I hate using the word culture because it's such a cliche word, but I don't have a better one for it. But just like setting a standard of what the Blackhawks have been doing this season is not acceptable in the long term. And I feel like if they can set that bar now, set that bar of what is expected out of them, that bar of expectations, set it very high right now. And don't, just because the circumstances aren't great for you, that you don't get complacent by that. You're still pushing for something, even if it seems unattainable, even if, you know, no one expects them to get to the playoffs, that there's at least an attempt by the players in the room to get to the playoffs, even if they fall 20 points shy at the end of the season, if not more. I like that is a thing they are doing right now, and hope it will, that when more talent gets here, if they have a similar determined mindset among the players in the room, that will lead to better results than the Maple Leafs are having, I guess, is where to get all this. Take a shot at Toronto. That's the way it works. I don't know if you, Betsy or Eric, if either one of you had thoughts, and I don't know if my rambling made sense, but either one of you have any reaction to the players only meeting?
Yeah, I think that's what Perry and Foligno were brought here to do, right? Is to lead and to teach them how to be pros. So that's like a tool for your tool belt. Right. To know when to do that and how to do that. And Lazarus got into it a little bit more with Jones today, and more it was, you know, them being open and honest and like all talking in the room about like, these are the types of mistakes we're making. These are the things that can't happen. So I think it's, you know, it's coachable moments or whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
Where and that's all good. I don't know if they were having any players only meetings last season. If they were, it was probably just to say goodbye to whoever just got traded.
right.
There's nothing. So the fact that they're disappointed and they're mad and they feel like there's some games that, you know, they should have won that they've been in, like, that's all good stuff. Whether or not it translates to any sort of different amount of success this year is almost irregardless. Yeah. It's, you know, teaching them what to do in the future, setting an expectation level, like you were saying, and that's all good. You want them to want to win every game and to be mad and to be pissed off when they lose, and not just to be like, okay with losing.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're setting that tone, that's a really good thing to be doing.
And I know, like, it is such a, you know, it's something you can say a lot. And it may not, and I feel like it's easy for sports fans to be cynical and think this is just people are just giving lip service to this, and they're just saying it to look good in front of the media. But I will swear, like, this is one of my sports hills that I will die on. Like, this shit matters. And I think you can look around plenty of teams, even at the professional level, not just hockey, but pick your sport. I mean, shit, look at the Bears right now. They got 86 acronyms for every aspect of football. But if you look at a team that all those players seem like they think they're going to lose every time they show up for a game, that's what that team looks like. And if there is something being done with the Blackhawks players, the young guys now, to where even if they lose 50 times this season, that they're not accepting that fate and that is being established now, I think that's a good thing for the long term. It doesn't necessarily – it's not a harbinger of success. They need more skill. They need to be better at the actual game of hockey. But this shit matters too, and I think you can see it when a team has it and when a team doesn't. And I think it's a very tricky, mysterious thing, and hopefully it works in the long run, but I at least like where this part of the equation is heading right now. Betsy, did you have any other thoughts to this?
No.
Okay.
I'm just saying ditto. I mean, I'm the same way. When they first initially said it, my thought was, that's weird. They just won against a good team. They just lost on a back-to-back to a good team. That's not like the worst loss they've had this season. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't, like, accountability is nice. Them pushing for more is good. Not being content to be, like, terrible. I mean, like I said, the New Jersey second period was one of their worst. So talking about that is great. So all the points that you and Eric made, I think, are good and true. I wouldn't be able to say anything more that would be better.
Well, yeah, then we won't have to call any players-only meetings after this podcast, so that's good. We do have one other thing we want to touch on really quickly related to Blackhawk stuff, and I think we're going to do that right on the other side of this timeout, so come on back for all of that. Welcome back to Musings on Madison here on the Second City Hockey Podcast Network. So we have one other Blackhawks-related topic we wanted to get to, and it's a less enjoyable thing. I assume anyone who listens to this podcast is probably aware that on Sunday, a second player from the 2010 Black Aces squad that was on the Blackhawks, was part of the practice squad, essentially, when they were making their run to the Stanley Cup that year, has filed a lawsuit against the Blackhawks, alleging a sexual assault from then video coach Brad Aldridge. The details are reported in the Tribune. There's a very lengthy article that goes into very detailed descriptions of everything that happened, and feel free to seek that article out if you're more interested. I'm not going to go through them all here because some of them are graphic and people may not want to hear that. So there's a content warning for anyone who might be sensitive to stuff of that nature. When this all came out on Sunday, like, I think my initial reaction to this was that I don't want to say, like, surprise it took this long, because it's different for every victim of in these situations, how long it takes for them to feel comfortable coming forward with their lawsuits. I think it was more just like, it didn't feel like that whole everything involved with what happened back in 2010 was, it didn't feel like it was over. And I guess this was just kind of a reminder that this cloud is still going to be around the Blackhawks for a good while. And even though pretty much all of the people involved in this from a Blackhawks organizational perspective aren't with the team anymore, it's still the Blackhawks that are getting named in this lawsuit. And I don't know where it's going to go. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not even going to pretend to be one here. But I don't know what else to say about that. Eric and Betsy, did either one of you have any thoughts on this?
Go ahead.
You go ahead, Eric. I'll talk a second.
No, I was going to say, Lazarus wrote a really good piece kind of about how you're straddling that line. You know, you want to be, all of us want to be so excited. You know, it was really, really hard to be a fan and, you know, in completely different ways for everybody who experienced it. I think after the initial Jenner and Block report came out and after everything was revealed, and, you know, like you just said, everybody, you know, most of the players that were still there, they're gone, you know, the front office, everyone who was involved in that, they are all gone, but that doesn't mean like the feelings are gone. And obviously everything that's happened to these players, you know, that doesn't go away just because it's, you know, Danny's running the team now, or because John McDonough is not there. Like, that doesn't fix anything. Yeah. All it does is there's a little bit of accountability attached to that now that obviously wasn't there at the time that this initially happened. So, but then, you know, you have these incredible kids that we spent all this time talking about. You have, you know, a different coach and a different GM. And, you know, like I just said, Danny's running the team now. You want to be excited. You want to turn the page. You want to move on. But it's really important to remember these things too, because that's whether or not we want it to be, it's a part of being a Blackhawks fan now. And it's something that, you know, in a weird, bizarre way, like, we have to kind of justify sometimes. And I think we were all ready to move on from that part of it. But, you know, it's, I don't know how much more there is as far as this case goes. There's a possibility there's other players too, you know, mm-hmm. that are going to come forward in the next few years. Like, we don't know. So it's not something, I guess the overall point he was making was, it's okay to be excited about the future. It's okay to be excited about the prospects of being a Blackhawks fan, but you can't forget about these things too. And I think it's just a reminder of that. And it's important that, you know, we don't forget that either, because it's a really big deal and it's a really terrible thing.
Yeah. And I guess, like, the hope, I mean, the only thing I would add to what you said and what I said earlier is just, like, whatever. I don't think there is any sort of attainable justification for the victim in this situation to get. Like, there's no compensation that will probably ever be adequate, but I hope whatever compensation they can get, they get. And if that gives them any level of solace or relief or whatever feeling they can get, whatever positive thing they can get from that, maybe some closure to the whole situation, I hope that happens for that player. But other than that, like, I don't know. I really, like, I feel like, similar to when it initially happened, like, I don't know what else to say other than it's a shitty situation. I wish it hadn't happened. I'm glad that the whole accountability thing gets, because I feel like there's been with the penalty the Ottawa Senators got, there are, anytime it seems like anytime any NHL team gets a penalty of any kind now, it gets immediately compared to the Blackhawks penalty for this whole situation. And I don't know if it's exactly an apples to apples comparison here. So I don't even know if I want to get into that conversation, but I feel myself rambling now. So I'm just going to turn this over to Betsy before I say anything else dumb.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't, we talk about how we'd like to move on, and it's, as fans, but it's impossible to do because, one, like you said, Dave, every time any other team is penalized for hockey operational type of things that impact the game at a bigger level. And I don't want to discredit that this doesn't impact the game at a certain level, because it does, but not on a tangible way that some of these other infractions are that the league considers, like, in their purview, you know. This should be, but it's not the same as tampering, or
it's like two different departments of punishment, I guess. I don't know how to say it accurately, but I get what the point you're trying to
convince. Yeah, exactly. So that'll always be brought up. And, like, technically the person who's putting this lawsuit forward wasn't even one of the people during the investigation that had initial complaints. So the whole idea is that, like Eric was like, there could be more players that come forward. There's a good chance there are, because there were at least four John Does in the initial Jenner and Block, whatever, investigation. And the first one was obviously Beach. And so that means there's three others. This one, who, it gets confusing because he's now known as John Doe. He was Black Ace One, who was technically just a witness in the first one. So that means there are five known. And that's not including that we know that Aldrich also harassed a female employee even after the allegations. So it's like, you know, this is going to be a larger impact than maybe people initially thought, that it could be like it's done with, but it's not really, because it's, and it's, I, the point you were trying to make earlier, I think, was it sucks that it took this for cultural changes to happen in an organization like the Blackhawks, and hopefully in the, like this impacts hockey, the NHL and hockey in general too. But it's good that these moves are being made to be safer for the players, more open for the players. Because one of the things that I liked about, you know, the lawyers for this Black Ace One, was like, because a lot of people try to discredit, especially male victims, were like, well, why didn't you fight back? And especially in hockey culture, where they're like, you're so much bigger than Aldrich. Why'd you take it, you know? And why didn't you just beat his face in? Isn't our hockey play? And it's like, well, power positions, stigma around, like, they don't even want to bring it up, that kind of stuff. So I encourage people to go read the full response about that, because it's a good reminder of these types of situations, of why people who are harassed, who are sexually assaulted, in any type of way, why they don't come forward, why it's hard for them to come forward, and especially men, especially male victims. And so it's just a reminder that we all have to be better. And I'm glad that the Blackhawks as an organization have implemented so many things, and hopefully they stay true to that. It sucks that it came at the expense of what is a bunch of young men, you know?
Yeah. It pretty much derailed Kyle Beach's entire career and his life off the ice. And I imagine there might have been similar circumstances related to their profession and not for this player. So, I think it might have been on the back burner for a while of the, like, this whole situation because of the exciting new era and all that. But I think this is definitely a reminder of, the Blackhawks really fucked up. And I think one of the most interesting things that I think has come out of this is the fact that Stan Bowman and Joel Quenneville both still do not have jobs in the NHL. And I think any coach with Quenneville's resume, or anybody with the resume that Bowman has, or the last name that Bowman has, gets fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh chances in the NHL, let alone seconds and thirds. So the fact that they still don't have jobs maybe means that, like, something did change as a result of this. And I was kind of lukewarm on the idea of either one of them getting jobs again in the NHL. And I feel like that's one thing that has come out in the last few days since the second report second lawsuit has been filed, is like, I think it is kind of reiterated in my mind that maybe those two don't need to work in the NHL again. Like, maybe this was such an egregious misstep by both of them, that maybe one of the results of that is they have forfeited their rights to work in the NHL anymore.
It's hard though, because Betsy brought it up in the chat when we were all talking about this initially. You know, why does Shovel Dayoff still have his job?
Yeah, that's
and
true.
You know, he was involved too. And this, you know, hockey culture, there's problems across the board, no matter what league, no matter what organization you're looking at. And, you know, it's power dynamics. It's all kinds of different things. We don't need to play armchair psychiatrist. But, you know, it's, and they were both, Bowman and Quenneville both kind of pleaded their case. Was it the GM meetings right before the season started? They showed up in Chicago and they talked to everyone. Or was it the owner? It was owners.
There was some sort of NHL executive thing where Quenneville and Bowman both spoke. Yeah.
And I mean, the premise was them speaking about, you know, supposedly supposed to be, this is how you help your players. You know, we had to learn from our mistakes.
Yeah. We, and these are the things we did. Yeah.
Yeah. you know, that was it. But I think it was really a mea culpa to be like, hey, you know, we would like the opportunity, both of us, to get back in the league. You know, we've learned from our mistakes, da, 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 da. This, you know, I think that's what you're saying. You know, this might serve as a reminder, like, yeah, what they did was bad enough. I agree with you. I don't think either of them should work in professional hockey. They should not be in charge of people. They, let alone, you know, just on a basic human level, they were terrible bosses or employees or however you want to put it. So they, no, I don't think either one of them should be bad.
At a very minimum, like, there's got to be some public mea culpa. And don't go to an NHL executive function and talk, you know, get in front of a podium, answer questions, explain what happened. There's been no, at a very minimum, if either one of them ever, like, for my money, if either one of them ever wanted to come back to the NHL in any sort of professional manner, you have to do some sort of public facing mea culpa that involves questions from people that are not pre-planned or scripted. You don't do like a TV interview with Liam McHugh or whoever. Like, get in front of a podium, answer questions, explain everything, and then maybe we'll entertain the idea. But unless they're going to do that, then I don't see how that ever happens.
Because I can't. Like, there's a whole thing that, you know, Eric was talking about. Like, there's power dynamics and, like, who had final say, because McDonough, from all reports, said, we're not going to deal with this now. It's his final decision. But Quinville didn't have to give Aldrich a positive end-of-year review. Bowman didn't have to let him have his day with the cup. You know, like, there were a bunch of stuff that were after the allegations and after he was technically given the option to resign, that they were a part of those decisions. And that particular, there's this whole thing about, like, a recommendation level. The Blackhawks technically did not give a recommendation level. Aldrich used the positive review as his recommendation. That came out during one of, like, after the investigation. But those are the things that you should be culpable for. Like, if your employee, like, all you have to do is not give him a good review. Like, you just don't give him a review.
Yeah.
You know, like, at bare minimum.
You don't have to say bad job, but you also don't have to say good job. You can just,
you know,
no reference is kind of a reference in itself.
Yeah. So, like, there are things that they, like, I can understand the argument that some people make of, well, McDonough was the be all end all and he was the big decision maker, but these were grown ass men in power positions themselves who were okay with letting certain things happen and then helped other certain things happen that made it possible for this guy to go and do further bad things. Because, you know, he was actually, he is technically a sex offender because he was found criminally, or, like, it's a federal offense of sexual assault of a 16-year-old. So, you know, like, those things could have maybe been prevented if the Blackhawks had done stuff. So I don't want to see them in the NHL again. I think you've lost the right to come back, personally. And I don't think any grandstanding in front of a podium. I think they should do that just regardless, just so that people who need closure, or so they can answer for their, I don't want to say crimes, but their mistakes. I think they could do that. It should be something like that. That would be good. But I don't think it should be for the sake of them getting their job back. But I will say, there are people who this doesn't care. Like, people do not care about this because that the ref, the former ref, Tim Peel, literally the day, lawsuit, like, hours after, like, it wasn't like it was before. It was, like, hours after the lawsuit, he tweeted, like, oh, the Edmonton Oilers really need Quinville. And I'm like, no. I mean, they need a coach, but they need a goalie more than they need a coach.
Yeah, they could use some defensemen, too, so.
Yeah. So, but I wouldn't want them back, even if they got on their knees. And
yeah.
And no one's ever publicly apologized to Kyle Beach in any fashion that I know of.
I'm sure, like, the Hawks probably did at some point in all their
statements. Yeah, I think it was, like, an organization they did.
I don't know. The thing that's really damning to me and that makes me be like, no, is, and this was in, I don't know if this was I saw this referenced in the article, and I don't know if they were referencing the initial Jenner and Block report or new information that come out, but we know that Beach was harassed after this, you know, while on the NHL team, after these men knew all of these things that happened to him and he was bullied for it. And then they were saying that, you know, this Black Ace one, John Doe, it was the same thing for him.
I don't think either one of them happened in the NHL. Both of those, the bullying supposedly happened in the AHL, I think.
Was it the AHL? Okay.
I believe so. The Black Ace ones, I'm like 90% sure it was AHL. And then Beach didn't play very much in the NHL. So if it happened, then it was like...
like maybe during training camp?
Yeah. Like
that's what I thought it was. Yeah. It was during training camps. But
yeah, his Hockey Reference page, he did not ever play in an NHL game.
Yeah, I was about to say I didn't...
Yeah. Like, I know, I remember, like, going through Getty Images archives, there are pictures of him in a Blackhawks uniform, so he had to play in preseason games at some point, but I guess...
Yeah, he definitely did. Yeah,
so,
okay.
So, I mean, well, I guess when, you know, if anything else comes of this topic down the road, I'm sure we'll talk about it then, and like I said, maybe there's other lawsuits coming down the road, but this, it sucks, but this thing is probably... It feels like this thing is not going to be completely gone for anytime soon. And it's always going to be there kind of as a reminder of just how much they fucked up with the initial mistake, mishandling of everything.
And yeah, they can't get rid of that. But I think that there's still ways that they can do things to try to help turn the conversation and, you know, improve things and make it right. So I think for all our sakes, we hope we see some of that, you know, going forward, regardless of what happens, the result of this case.
Yeah. Yep. Hopefully this is the last set of incidents we ever have to talk about in this manner. Hopefully. So I don't have a good way to transfer to segue out of that into other things, but just kind of looking ahead to the Blackhawks schedule for the next week. They, again, very light part of the schedule for some reason. On Thursday, they play in Tampa. They have Friday and Saturday off, and they have a very strange 12 o'clock Central Time game in Florida against the Panthers. I have no idea if there's something going on in the state of Florida or in Sunrise that's a holiday, that why they're playing on a Sunday at noon. It's not a national broadcast game. Maybe they're doing that because the Bears play on Thursday night, so they knew they could sneak in a Blackhawks game on a Sunday afternoon and get decent ratings. I don't know. It's a very weird time to be playing a hockey game, but those are the next two Blackhawks games, and then they don't play again till the following Thursday against the Tampa Bay Lightning once again. So if you were hoping for some easier games on the Blackhawks schedule, keep waiting because they're not coming anytime soon. Maybe the back half of this month. So, I don't really have any other Blackhawks related thoughts. Anything else we missed, Betsy or Eric? I think we covered most of it.
No, I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, if we're not nothing else on this internet, we are the best food themed hockey podcast. And as I mentioned at the top, I didn't watch any of the Hawks games this weekend, or most of them, because I was out of town down in New Orleans because I'm a glutton for sports punishment, and I watched the Bears lose in person because that's what I do, I guess. But I was also a glutton in a much different way because I ate all the food that New Orleans could possibly offer. So much jambalaya, so much seafood, and so many beignets. Eric, you were one of like five people who recommended Cafe Du Monde to me.
Oh, yeah.
We went on Saturday, and it was so good. We went back again on Sunday, and some people in our group even went back again a third time on Monday. So if you go to New Orleans, like, highly recommend New Orleans as a city in general. We were only there for a few days, so we were mostly limited to the French Quarter. So there's a ton to do there, and I'm sure there's plenty of other parts of that city worth exploring because it seems just like a very – vibrant culturally, very cultural. There's like art everywhere. There are art markets everywhere. It's a very interesting place. And I mean that as a very much positive way. Go check it out. Seriously, it's a great city. But the food in particular, and I've been wrestling with what exactly the thought is, because my favorite meal I had that whole week was at a place called Daisy May. Are either one of you familiar with this place?
Uh-uh.
It's a chicken and waffles place.
Do love chicken and waffles.
Oh, it's, you know what? If there's one thing we could steal from the South, the idea of chicken and waffles for breakfast. Oh my God. I need to know how they deep fry the chicken at this place, because there's something about the breading that is unique that I've never had. I feel like I've never had it before. And I take it back. I feel like I've had it in one or two other places that are also incredibly memorable fried chicken meals that I've had. And it's something about the breading, either how it is prepared or the breading itself. And I don't know if it's like a flour or cornstarch thing. I don't know if it's a type of oil thing, but there's like a flakier nature to it, and it tastes incredible. And either one of you have any idea of what I'm talking about here with the differences between the breading on a fried chicken?
Well, sometimes it's the way that they treat the chicken too. And like the big thing is if they soak it in buttermilk for dinner days before. Or... Yeah, exactly. Whether they're nice to the chicken or not before they. But I know that has a lot to do with it. And no, I mean, it's like any food stuff. Once you start looking into it, there's the different types of oil and the different temperatures. And sometimes they fry it twice there's something like, when you hit a place, there's something magic. And a lot of times it could even just be like the spice rub that they use, you know, with the flour that they dredge it in. But I know now I want to go to Daisy May when I'm in New Orleans next time.
There's also like whether or not they do an egg wash or if there's buttermilk involved, because lots of people don't like sometimes you can get crispier without an egg wash, which to some people also is sacrilege. So like, it's an interesting, it'll like soak it in buttermilk is a really thing. Like a lot of people really like to do that down here. Lard, whether or not they use lard versus oil, you know, it's like, I wish we could find out, like, be like, just go to that restaurant and be like, tell me your
I really wish I would have asked somebody. I like, that is one of my goals for the winter, is I want to experiment with making my own fried chicken and doing it in the best way possible. So there's one other food that I had that I had never heard of until I feel like I saw it in a bunch of other, I just saw it like a bunch of restaurants either featured it as, it was the world famous, this, it's called a muffaletta, and I might be saying that wrong. Have either one of you heard of this?
Yeah.
Eric, have you? Cause this, all right. So I was the late one to this game. According to Wikipedia, it's just a type of round Sicilian sesame bread. It felt like a sandwich hot pocket type of thing. The way it was, like all the meat and everything was inside. I think there was like ham, salami, cheese, and olives in it. In the one that I had, which I think is the traditional muffaletta thing, but I don't think it's necessarily. It looks like from here, like this from again the Wikipedia description. It's usually olive salad. I guess that's where the olives were. Olive salad, salami, ham, Swiss cheese, provolone, and mortadella. So I had one. It was delicious.
I don't like olives, so I'm always like,
The olives are probably the least enjoyable part of that sandwich, but it was still very good.
It's a good sandwich. You didn't have any, like I asked you ahead of this, you didn't have any gumbo, but you did you say you had jambalaya?
I had a lot of jambalaya. I had so much jambalaya.
Did you have any etouffee?
Yes. One place I went to is called Oceana Grill. I got, the order I got was Taste of New Orleans. It was a crawfish etouffee, jambalaya, and then red beans and rice all together.
I realized when we were saying earlier, I was like, I can make so many. I can make less than 10 dishes, but I think actually I might be able to make more because I can make etouffee too. Two different gumbos. I can only make one jambalaya and an etouffee. So. Trying to think of anything else that you could have had there.
Let me circle back for a second and ask you a question.
Yeah.
How was the waffle at Daisy May?
The waffle was just incredible. It was soft and fluffy and just a delightful compliment to the fried chicken.
Cause every time I've gone for chicken waffles, one of the components is fantastic, and the other one is very lacking. I have yet to go or eat it somewhere where like both things are A-level quality.
Well, I guess, so I just got the basic chicken and waffles plate. The two people on opposite sides of me, including friend of the show, Lewis, I know he's listening to this, so I'll give him credit for ordering this. He got the chicken and waffle sandwich where the waffle was the bread part of the sandwich. And he, like the whole time, like we were sitting next to each other as we were eating and we didn't really say words. We just kind of grunted just in approval of what we were eating. And then we were done. You just kind of lean back in your chair and just like you just lay there just like in the full contentment of a full belly and a great taste in your mouth from everything you just enjoyed.
Those are the best. Those are the moments.
Yeah. Like we were seriously talking about going there before and after the Bears game on Sunday, but we ran out of time beforehand and then they closed at 3. So we couldn't get there after the game. But if I go back to New Orleans, that is one of the first places I'm going to. It's called Daisy May. It's right near the Superdome. Like on the edge of the French Quarter. It's a great place. Highly recommend if you ever
in. Is it hole in the Wally? Because in Atlanta. Yes. Yeah, okay, yeah. Because in Atlanta, I will say they have good at like nicer restaurants or more like higher. I don't want to say high. Like that's a weird way. But the ones that look more hole in the wall typically have better. Like both of them are going to hit at 100%.
Yeah, like that's I'm 1,000% in agreement with you. There's another place I tried talking our group into going to, but I got vetoed because they apparently looked too hole in the wally for.
You're like that looks like too much of a hole. We're not going into that.
Yeah, I didn't want to like make like some big proclamation food take of like New Orleans is the best food city I've ever been to. I think that would be incredibly short-sighted of me because I haven't been to enough food cities, but for the love of God, go to New Orleans and eat the food. That's my food take. Go there. Yeah.
I was going to say there's a TikTok guy who's British and he was like in America for like 2 or 3 months or something like that. And you could tell he spent a lot of time in the South because when he left, all of his favorite food takes were Southern food. And I feel like a lot of times that's when people come from other regions, they come to the South, they automatically are like, this was my favorite food now.
Right.
Yeah. Southern food doesn't get enough credit for how good it is. But it's also, I think, like in particular, food in Louisiana takes the best parts of French cooking and mushing it with other parts of, it's not just French, you know, they have like lots of African and Spanish influences too, because they all were brought into that region and it all just makes just beautiful, beautiful food.
Well, that's even, there's a lot of Caribbean influence too. And like when we were in the Caribbean, like my wife got super into like chicory coffee and there's a lot of stuff that translates and even like Haitian too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hodgepodge, like whatever they did, they've taken the best of everything and been like, and now we will make it even better. And you're like,
it's like food Darwinism. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I think that like this just kind of speaks to what about, I think I've talked about this earlier, like the idea of like if a New Orleans themed restaurant opened up either like somewhere in the Chicagoland area, like it'd be cool. But I feel like if you really want like the experience of that food, like you have to go to the city itself, because it's like every place you go to, you know, the entrees are the same. The sides are the same. Like it's a similar idea of letting you know, this is the type of food that exists in this area. And this is where you can experience it. And you can get like 3 or 4 different versions of the same dish and get an idea of what's good about it. What other places do it well and what other places don't. So maybe that's the food take, is like going back to one point I know I made before, is if you want to experience the regional food of any region, go there. Don't just go to the, you know, don't go to the Cajun style. Don't go to Yats and think you've had Cajun food before. Go to New Orleans, get the thing for real. And don't be afraid of the holes in the wall restaurants, because hole in the wall restaurants, I don't know where the S goes in that, but yeah. Don't be afraid of the hole in the wall restaurant, because that's probably where the best food is.
Yeah, because all they care about is the food. They don't care about the walls. They care about what they're making in the kitchen. Who cares about the walls? I'll go eat outside.
Yeah, I'll eat on the curb.
I've had great meals sitting on a curb. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's where we had the beignets initially, was sitting on the curb outside the cafe.
Absolutely, because you don't want to walk anywhere else. So you want to go 5 steps away from the stand and stuff them in your face.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm a big fan of people who take road trips through a region. Like, if you're going, because New Orleans obviously has great food, but like Baton Rouge does it slightly different. And I spent a lot of summers in Abbeville, which is like 30 minutes south of Lafayette. And it's right, like, if you look at the map, it looks like it's nothing but swamplands below that, but it's all rice paddy stuff. So like on my grandmother's house, you walk out the porch and it's just rice fields. And my cousins would go out and like, we're going to get some crawfish from here, you know? Mm-hmm. They didn't call them crawfish. They called them crawdaddies, but same thing. And the way that they do food is just slightly different. And it's such an interesting way. If you just make your way through a state and stop at any hole in the wall, I feel like just look for whatever, look it up online, look to see what's good. And if it looks, has good stars and looks kind of run down, beautiful, go to it.
That is the nice thing with like having Google and Yelp reviews and all that is a place that has, you know, looks very run down and shitty from the outside. There can still be people on Google telling you, no, this is the place to go. Don't be worried about the appearance.
I'm going to give you both a gift and anyone who's still listening at this point. Roadfood.com. It is a website.
What?
That's all it is. And they classify the places based on like the expertise level. If anything is listed as a legendary on that website, no matter how far out of your way you have to drive to get there, it is 1,000,000% worth it. It is, and it's a lot of like older diners and kind of like roadside stuff and hole in the wall stuff. But yeah, roadfood.com. The website itself is kind of weird. It takes a second to figure it out, but it has never, ever let me down. And you can look by like region, by state, by city. And then it'll show you like specialties and stuff. But yeah, okay. Thumbs up.
Eric,
big time thumbs up.
This is the best thing you've ever said on this podcast. Just want you to know that because I've already found it. I've been clicking around and like now all I want
to
do.
Okay, is, now we need to go back and Connor Bedard tier that part of the podcast.
This is only for the well. I assume those are the only people who are still listening to this podcast.
I already take a little. I just looked up Atlanta and they have the Varsity as one of the very top things. And I'm already like, should I believe it?
Uh-oh. No.
Naysaying Betsy.
I mean, maybe the one in Athens, but not the one in Atlanta, which is the famous one. The Varsity is just a...
Is it listed as legendary?
One of the best.
Yeah, no. That's not legendary.
Okay, I'll take that. I was immediately like, no, they just put one in the town next to us. And my nephew was like, yeah, the Varsity. And I was like, oh my God, please don't think that that's great food. Oh, never mind. They have some pretty good ones on here.
Yeah. I'm cruising around some areas I know. So and I'm seeing a lot of places that I would also recommend. So worth a shot. Worth a shot. Worth a detour, worth a return, as the rating system is at the website. So there we go. We got somewhere in the end. Roadfood.com. Great.
Roadfood.com.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, if there's not any other thoughts, I think that's going to do it. And for this edition of Musings on Madison, anything else to add? Any other food takes or Blackhawk takes or what have you?
No.
I guess not. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. If you made it all the way to the end of this, hope you got, if nothing else, you got a great road trip recommendation out of it. And there's a couple Blackhawks games coming up in the next few days. And we'll be back next week to talk all about them. And we will talk to you then.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.